From KLW News in San Francisco, this is a special edition of Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
Coming up...
It was a burglary that turned into a murder.
Don Kronk spent 28 years behind bars before being released.
Most men my age have bought and sold 2-3 homes, their kids are raised, they're retiring from their jobs... I got 3 boxes.
Nancy Mullane wrote a book about the people known as lifers.
What are we looking for after they've done that sentence? And then what happens when they actually do go before the parole board? And do they ever get out?
Mullane found that people sentenced to life with the possibility of parole rarely get out. And she wanted to understand why and what it costs society. That's the subject of this special edition of Cross Currents. Between 2000 and 2009, 57,000 men and women convicted of murder were released from state and federal prison. Let me repeat that. Around 57,000 convicted murderers are living among us. By the time they're released, they've usually served decades behind bars. They're a generation older than when they went to prison, and when they come out, they fade from view. No sensational headlines, no fanfare. We rarely think about them ever again. And they make their way on the outside in a world that can be very different from the one they left.
You know, freedom is... it's got its costs. My name is Don Kronk. I served 28 years in state prison for first-degree murder. I was sentenced to 25 years to life.
Don Kronk left San Quentin State Prison in April 2009. His time in prison and what it took to get out are the subject of a new book by reporter Nancy Mullane. It's called Life After Murder, and it tells the stories of Kronk and 4 other men convicted of homicide with the possibility of parole. Nancy and Don join me in studio. We'll start at the beginning with Don's story.
It was a burglary that turned into a murder. And the burglary was well planned. I was addicted to cocaine and at one point was selling it and then used everything and I owed all this money. And of course, in that underworld, you know, your cohorts are in the like situation. And I had this friend that was an ex-felon. He had done some robberies. And Mr. Allen, the man that I ended up shooting, he came to our attention through a third party that he owned a jewelry store and that he carried all the proceeds and the jewels home with him every evening. So the plan was we would go to his home, break in, wait for him, surprise him, tie him up. Actually, we had tape, duct tape. Take his briefcase, and if we thought he may have had a safe, we were going to get him to open the safe and then leave. So that was the plan, and obviously it didn't go that way. And we got to the house. We had masks. We had gloves. We had the tape. My cohort even had a club. He was a pretty stocky guy. He was going to be the muscle. I had a gun in my pocket. At the time, I weighed about 155 pounds, and I was 24 years old, not intimidating at all. And I knew that... if I were to ask you for your money, give me your money or else, you'd probably laugh at me. But if I had a gun, even if I just show it, you're probably going to comply. So I had it in my pocket. I'd never shot it before this. And it was more just for intimidation. Well, it went horribly wrong. We were supposed to have the surprise. So when Mr. Allen came in, we'd surprise him. And it should have been relatively easy to get him, you know, in our control. Somehow he was alerted to our presence in the house, and when he walked in, I was in another part of the room, and I heard a noise. I thought it was my co-defendant. I walked out of a kitchen area, and there he was, standing in the door. And my thoughts were, how did he get in here without us knowing about it? And he just shot me. He just opened fire. The next thing I know, I was laying on the ground against the wall. I obviously had been hit, but I didn't feel it at that point, and I returned fire. I shot one time through my coat pocket, and it hit Mr. Allen. He died, and I didn't die. Looking back on it, it's a ridiculous activity I was involved in. It was just a series of very poor decisions coupled with addiction and, of course, greed. and selfishness and just thinking about myself. You know, so this happens. It takes seconds. I mean, it was just a few seconds and it was over. And I was in shock, apparently, because I still didn't realize that I'd been hit until I got outside. And then I felt something in my boot, my pants, and then a few minutes later, I could hear it in my lungs, a gurgling sound and all that. And I didn't think I was going to make it, but I did. You know, I always try to, whenever I make a public appearance or speak to anyone at all, I always make sure that I apologize for what I did against society. I mean, it affects a whole society, and not just the victim's family and my family, but society as a whole. And I really mean that. I am so sorry for what I did, and I can never, ever pay it back. And so all I can do now is try to contribute and give back the best that I can.
Do you remember your first day in prison, what that was like?
Well, I do. I had never been arrested. And so your handcuffs are on, you're in the car, you go to the facility. Usually it's a jail first. And at that point, you lose your identity. You lose who you are. You're stripped down. You're probed every part of your body. It's just so humiliating and embarrassing. And you're given a number. And from that point forward, you are no longer, I was no longer Don or Mr. Kronk, or I was just a number, C87286, period. And you soon learn that you will follow the rules. You eat what they provide, when they provide it. You shower whenever you get the opportunity. You know, the lights go on, the lights go off, you will work. It's just, and then there's the machismo and the tension inside, and nobody wants to be there, obviously, and the depression. There are people in there with severe psychological problems. And then you're celled in this very small cell, which the SPCA, by law, cannot house a single dog in the size of, and there's two men in here. And you don't ever know who it is. You never know who it is. It could be somebody like you that's just trying to get through, could be somebody who's extremely violent and has no intention of ever changing. It could be someone psychotic, and you're forced to live in these cells. And so what you think or your opinion or your desire or wishes just don't count.
Don was sentenced to 25 years to life with the possibility of parole. I asked Nancy to explain what that means.
Well, in California, there's approximately 30,000 people living inside the prison system in the 32 institutions in the state that are living with a life with the possibility of parole sentence. The way the law works in California is when you go before the parole board, depending on over the last 20 years, somewhere between 3% and 10% of those who go before the parole board who have done that work are found suitable.
So just a handful. And I think that somebody from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation said to you, life without parole is essentially a death sentence.
Yes, that was Bill Sessa. He's a spokesperson for the California Department of Corrections in Sacramento. And, you know, when I first began looking at this population of individuals serving this sentence, it was just because I was doing a story on prisons. And that's when I first met these individuals behind the walls of San Quentin who had committed a murder, and yet we're doing a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. So I began that question of, well, who are people after they commit a murder and they are given this sentence of a possibility of a second chance on the outside? And then what is it that we want from them? What are we looking for after they've done that sentence? And then what happens when they actually do go before the parole board, and do they ever get out? And what we found is, you know, even if you're one of those 3% that are found suitable each year of the now 6,000-7,000 that go before the parole board, you still have to face in California a governor review because of a law that was passed in 1988 by the voters of California that gave the governor the authority to reverse someone who was that parole date. So
that essentially politicizes it.
Well, exactly, because the governor, you know, the governor has actions. The governor does appoint the parole board members. The commissioners on the parole board are appointed directly by the governor. And then after they have been appointed, they then have to be approved by the state Senate. So there is, you know, this separation where the governor has the opportunity to have his voice heard and who he wants reviewing these parole board considerations. And the Senate also has an opportunity. But to add then a third layer where it goes back to the governor after the person has been found suitable has put such a political weight on this process that is why the CDCR now says that if someone is given a life sentence with the possibility of parole in California, that they have a greater chance of dying in prison than ever getting parole.
Did you ever have to justify to yourself, well, who's going to want to read this book? Society has essentially shut its doors on these people, doesn't really care very much. Somebody who's committed murder, why do we care that they get a second chance?
Well, I think that's the part where the reporter comes in. And I think that, you know, as a reporter, when you have a question and you know you've never heard the answer, that's where there's something inside you just burns. And because that's our job. That's a reporter's job, is maybe everybody else is ignoring it. Maybe they're ignoring it because they've stopped asking the question. But when you hear that question in your mind, then you know, I've got to get the answer. And I thought, well, I'll just ask the warden. Then I'll just ask the officers. Then I'll just ask the CDCR. And every time I asked the question, I kept getting the answer, we don't know. We don't really know how many who have gotten out of prison on a murder conviction with the possibility of parole sentence have ever come back. So,
and you did find the answer. And the answer is?
I did find the answer. And it did take me from 2007 until 2011. So it took me 4 years of Public Records Act requests to finally get that answer. And what we found was that in 21 years of the 1,000 individuals who had been sent to prison in California for murder with a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, who had been found suitable for parole and been released from prison, of those 1,000, not one went back to prison in 21 years for another murder. In fact, less than 1% committed any kind of a felony at all. So when you compare that with the recidivism rate of the other felonies that are committed in California and released from prison, that's 70%. So what we're actually doing is we're making it more and more difficult for individuals who are sent to prison with a possibility of parole, meaning they have to do everything they can possibly do. And, you know, in California, the budget that has been approved by the legislature for rehabilitation programs in prisons has been eviscerated. There are very few programs, there is no university level education because of a law that was passed by President Bill Clinton in 1996. All federal funding for university programs in prisons in the United States have been removed. So we send these individuals to prison in California saying, now do everything you can to better yourself. And then we remove all of the programs and all of the education. And they actually do everything they can to create those programs in prison. So when I started discovering this population behind the walls, these men who were going before the parole board and being reversed, or not being found suitable and then suitable and reversed 150 days later, men like Don Kronk, I realized that it was a population we just didn't know.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're speaking with journalist Nancy Mullane, author of the new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We're joined by Don Kronk, one of the five men profiled in her book. Don was sentenced to 25 years to life after committing a murder in 1980. In 1998, he got his first shot at parole. I asked him to tell us about going before that board for the first time.
So you finally get there and you know, I walk in and I'm handcuffed and I'm wearing my prison clothes and of course everyone is in suits and it's very somber and you know, it's obviously very serious. And then the hearing begins and you're given an opportunity to say, you know, take responsibility for what you've done, talk about your achievements in prison, your parole plans, and as far as you could make them while you're in prison. And
what kind of questions do they ask you?
Well, it varies. You know, it ranges. Sometimes it's just straightforward, and other times they're like trick questions. It's
like what?
It's really, really challenging, and it seems that there's never really a right answer, no matter what the question is. And then ultimately, 2-3 hours, this process will go on, and they take a recess. You come back, and you're denied. The first time I was denied, it was for 4 years, and it was shocking.
Explain what that means. So you go through this hearing, you're trying to convince them that you're suitable for parole, and then what happens?
Well, I'd gone in there with expectations. I had hoped that they would see my accomplishments and my change, and they would, you know, hear me speaking about this crime and the victim's family and the changes and things that have occurred in my life and, you know, their lives, and that, you know, it would really be seen as a real valid, viable thing that I had accomplished, and it's just glossed over. And I'm in there thinking that hearing the words of the law that says you normally shall be found suitable, and I'm hearing him tell me I will be denied for 4 more years, which means that I'll go back in the prison and I won't have another opportunity for 4 years. And during that time, you're expected to continue progress and you know, whatever improvements you can, education or what, you know, self-help groups, whatever, which I'd like to add is all possible because of volunteers in the community. Even though Schwarzenegger added the R, CDCR, rehabilitation, the state doesn't put a penny toward rehabilitation, yet they expect us to rehabilitate somehow. They'll teach you how to boil beans and mop a floor, but they don't provide education other than GED. And in the early years, they didn't even do that.
So you get denied parole. This is after spending 18 years mm-hmm. in prison, and you have to wait 4 more years. Mm-hmm. What happens the next time?
So I go to the next time, and I've got even more things in my arsenal. I have my AA degree and certificates and other things that I've accomplished and letters of support and community support. Again, a flawless record, no disciplinaries. So I thought, well, certainly they'll find me suitable this time because the law says you shall normally be found suitable. And I went through the whole process again and recess, come back, denied 1 year. And that went on 5 more times. And then finally, my 7th hearing, they found me suitable.
What was that day like for you?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the hearings are so, it's such a cookie cutter, that the process, that when we come back from recess, you normally sit back at the tables, they turn the tape recorder on, and the verbiage is always the same. The board reconvenes, it's such and such a time, so and so and so are present, and the board finds you not suitable for parole, and then they go into this long spiel. So we come back, we sit down, they do all the legal stuff, and then they say, and the board finds you suitable for parole. And she goes on, just like all the times that I was denied. She said it so quickly that I didn't catch the find you suitable. I thought it was find you not suitable. So I looked over at my attorney sitting there, and I thought I'd see thumbs up, and he'd be smiling, and he was just almost collapsed in his chair. And I thought, well, maybe I didn't hear correctly. The first thing I think is now I've got to tell Kathleen, my fiance, denied again, you know, because they hold on hope, you know, just like us. And so she continued on with the normal verbiage. And then suddenly she looked at me and she said, now let's discuss why we found you suitable today. And that's when I just broke down. I just broke down. I uncontrollable crying, sobbing. The officers even brought me tissues and stuff, and which I thought was very nice.
Nancy, can you explain what you think works and doesn't work with the parole system as is?
Well, I think what works is when we sent Don Kronk to prison for murder, we as a society have expectations. You know, Don is a man who was using drugs, selling drugs, had gotten himself into a situation where he shot a man and killed a man. At that moment, we as a society need to know that there is going to be he's going to be held accountable for that. And what we do is we take them to court, give them one of a number of sentences. One sentence could have been the death penalty. Another sentence could have been life without the possibility of parole. But based on the conditions of Don's crime, he was given life with the possibility of parole. But there's a long list of things that he is expected to accomplish while he's in prison, so that when he goes before the parole board, that parole board is going to be able to determine whether or not he is someone who is, quote, no longer a threat to public safety. Now, that's a huge standard. That's a standard that means, and for many commissioners, they say that means they would be willing to have Don Kronk live right next door to them. So they're looking at this individual sitting across the table from them, and they're studying them. I mean, that parole board hearing is very intensive, and there is a certain cookie cutter element to it, as Don describes. But I think it also is they take that responsibility very seriously, the commissioners who sit across the table. And they have this huge folder that documents everything about their crime, about their time in prison. So if they are misbehaving in prison, if they are violating laws in prison or the rules, they'll know that. But the other thing is sometimes as much as smoking a cigarette can be a disciplinary action. So if you smoke a cigarette, they can say, you know, see, you don't know, you're not playing by the rules. The rules say no smoking, you're not ready to be out in society. Well, I think that, you know, my examination of this process and of these individuals has been looking at how the law actually works. We have a system of laws. And if the law says that you go to prison for this period of time and then you begin going before the parole board and you shall be found suitable if you have a good record, and then the commissioners that are appointed, you know, often do not, as we mentioned before, do not find these individuals suitable. And then they are not found suitable again and again and again. And these men are living these years in prison where they continue to do everything they can to prove, to show that they have, shown remorse for their crime. They have rehabilitated themselves, that they have the goal of redemption inside them, and that they have, when they are found suitable, they actually have to have a job on the outside. They have to have a safe place to live. So the plan is that if we let these individuals out, they're going to come back into society and they're going to thrive. But then we make it so difficult for them to get out that by the time, you know, and even for those who do get out, when they're released from prison, we give them a $200 after 20 years in prison, 30 years in prison. So, you know, I do think that the parole board has a place, and I think that incentive has a place. But I think, you know, that whole process has just become very politicized. And, you know, when we appoint people to the parole board who are former DAs, former correctional officers, former sheriffs, you know, they come with a certain perspective. And I think one thing that might help make the parole board more representative of society's need or desire for redemption or for rehabilitation is to make that parole board more representative of society, you know, appoint individuals who have a broad perspective.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with ex-inmate Don Kronk and reporter Nancy Mullane, author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. Don Kronk is one of the men profiled in her book. He went to prison in 1984 for committing murder.
So, Don, you've just told us about going before the parole board for years and years and years, getting rejected, not found suitable for parole. Finally, what year was it?
2008.
Finally, in 2008, you're found suitable for parole. When did you find out that the governor had reversed it?
No, I'm sorry. It was 2007. I was found suitable. And then there's a 150-day period where the governor has that opportunity. Well, during that time, you know, it's just surreal. You've hoped for this for so long, and now you've been given it. And you know, for me, it was a sense of validation that, okay, I believed, I hung on. All I wanted was fairness and justice to work. You know, I admitted my crime. I was sentenced fairly, and I thought, rightfully so, and I'll do everything I can to change. So now, finally, after all these years, I'm found suitable, and it's just, you know, I was ecstatic. Everything looked different. Life was different.
I remember the day when I walked into the prison, and I had seen Don, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 times before. I walked in and saw him standing in front of the chapel, and I remember looking at you and thinking, what happened? Because he was standing there in front of the chapel with this mug in his... Do you remember that moment? Mm-hmm. He was standing with this mug in his hand, and it was a coffee cup, and he had this... His shoulders were back, and his your legs were even, like, firmly planted on the ground, and you were looking out, and your chest was open. And I thought, oh, what? Wow. What's happened to Don Kronk? And I walked over, and I said, what happened to you? And you said...
I was found suitable for parole. You know, there is a weight. It felt like a weight. 100-pound weight was taken off my shoulders. And then conversely, I noticed that things that I had lived with for all these years, the smells, the food, the standing in lines, all the stuff that goes on in prison, suddenly it was like I was seeing it for the first time because I realized that this could be over. This could be it. I could really be going home. I'd try not to think about it. You know, you know that the numbers are against you. You know the odds are against you, but you keep that hope.
When were you ultimately released and how?
I was released in April of 2009, and my parole officer came to the prison and picked me up and drove me in his car to my home in San Anselmo. And just that, it was just surreal. I didn't feel like it was real. This was a Disneyland, a Disney World ride times 10. I mean, it was just being in a car, sitting in the front seat without handcuffs was, phenomenal. And then the sights and the smells and the colors and how fast everything is. All the electronic stuff, and it was overwhelming. But pulling up to that house and getting out of the car, and 28 years I had contained in 3 little boxes. That was my life. That's all I had to show for it. And it's an awesome feeling of joy, but the real challenge begins then.
There's this beautiful chapter in the book where Nancy writes about Kathleen, your fiancé, preparing for you to come home. And she didn't know which day you would get there, and she prepared. She didn't know what that first meal should be. And so she prepared everything she could possibly think of, and she put it all into the refrigerator. And it's just this poignant, really beautiful moment. What was it like on your side? What did you ultimately eat, and what was that reunion like?
Well, I told Kathleen, I said, when I think the first thing I'd like to eat is some nice, thick, juicy pork chops. We're not allowed to eat pork, and we don't get much meat in prison anyway, and I always liked pork chops. And I just thought, and I, throughout the years of visiting in the visiting room, other women that came to see men, friends of mine, well, they form a little bond and family, and so they would have dinner. Kathleen would often cook for these women. So for years and years and years, I always heard what an awesome cook she is. She's Italian, and everything is authentic. And so I couldn't wait, and I just thought, boy, pork chops. And I think that's what we had that evening. But yet, I was looking at the house and doors that close, and lights I turn on and off, and comfortable bed and couch, and it was just, it was just overwhelming. It's really hard to describe because it was everything I saw: trees, the street, the little dog, PJ, our little dog, books. Everything was just surreal, bigger than life. And again, I was smiling. I wanted to embrace it. I was so, overjoyed. But in the back of my mind, I knew I have to get a job. I have to make money. I didn't know if I could. All those years of preparing myself and selling myself to the parole board that I can do this. I can make it. I will make it. It was very intimidating as well.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with journalist Nancy Mullane, author of the new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We're also joined by Don Kronk, a man recently paroled after serving 28 years for murder. Don's only had one job in 3.5 years since his release. Employment is a major hurdle for ex-cons. I asked Nancy to explain some of the challenges.
When an individual who's done 20, 30 years in prison gets out and they get that $200. In fact, Dawn, I don't think you got your $200 right away. You had to wait for it.
It was like almost a year.
So the $200 obviously disappears. I mean, buy a bus ticket, you go out and go to grocery shopping and don't even think about first and last for an apartment. One individual who got out after 24 years told me that he went to look at an apartment with his fiance. And when he went, he got past the first application process. And when he went for the interview, they said, so where did you live last? And he was honest. He said, I was in prison. And they said, what for? Homicide. And they said, you know, you need to go find a felony friendly apartment building. And when he told me that, I thought, I don't really think there are felony-friendly apartment buildings, and there aren't felony-friendly jobs. So what I've witnessed is that individuals get out. They have extensive training. They now are educated. They have a very good record in prison without any disciplinary actions. And then they have this huge hope, and then they're found suitable, and then they're reversed, and then they're found suitable again, and then maybe they get out. Maybe the governor doesn't reverse the next time. Or as in Don's case, you know, they file an appeal. They challenge the governor's reversal in court, and the court orders the prison to release them, that the governor doesn't have weight. And they get out, and there's this huge kind of sense of euphoria. You know, they're on the outside, they're free, and then they spend months or years applying for every job they can think of. One of the men in that I profile in the book, Jesse Reed, he found work from midnight to 8 in the morning cleaning up from the Oakland A's, or the basketball. What is the basketball team in?
Warriors.
The Warriors, the Oakland Warrior game. So he would go in at midnight, and he said he'd never worked so hard. They would clean up the Coliseum. It was work that he could get. But to get a good full-time job with health benefits is nearly impossible. The one place people have found they can get work is if they are in an interview with someone who says, you know, I have a brother or I have a cousin who was incarcerated for something. And, you know, I would want that, you know, my brother or my cousin to have a chance. I'm going to give you a chance. So sometimes it's individuals who have known people who have done prison terms and have gotten out who are the most likely to give individuals a second chance at a job.
And is that probably the hardest thing about being out? The economic survival?
I think so. The rest of it is doable. You know, you can you learn to manage the rest of your life, but the jobs, I realized that I wasn't going to get a job, especially in this economy. I mean, there were people that had never been incarcerated that very skilled and couldn't get a job. So I decided, well, then I'm going to have to learn a skill. I was an electrician. So I thought, well, what can I learn that, you know, is needed and is today? So I went to College Marin and learned how to repair computers. And then along with that, I learned desktop publishing. And so I'm self-employed, actually. And I survive. I live, thanks to Kathleen and all. I live actually pretty well, but it's not enough to sustain me on my own.
Was there anything that you thought in 28 years being in prison that you were waiting for on the outside that then was a disappointment?
Boy, you know, every day is such a blessing to me still. In fact, when I go to bed at night, I open my window that's right above my head and I feel this cool breeze come in. And that's when I pray. And I also pray for the men inside. And I just know that they would do anything to feel and smell this cool, fresh air coming across their face as they were in this comfortable bed. I, except for the employment situation, I mean, I just thought that I would, I have skills, I'm personable, I work hard. I just thought I would have a job, a good job by now, and beginning to build a life. You know, I'm going to be 56 years old, and most men my age have bought and sold 2-3 homes, their kids are raised, they're retiring from their jobs. I got 3 boxes.
Don Kronk left San Quentin State Prison in April 2009. His time in prison and what it took to get out are the subject of a new book by reporter Nancy Mullane. It's called Life After Murder, and it tells the stories of Kronk and 4 other men convicted of homicide with the possibility of parole. And that's it for today's Cross Currents. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Artiems Kunahoffs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.